Are you ready to unlock a secret to youthful vitality? Meet MitoPure, the revolutionary urolithin A supplement from Timeline Nutrition. MitoPure ignites mitophagy, your body's natural anti-aging pathway. As we age, our cells can become damaged and dysfunctional. But with MitoPure, you can recycle these worn-out cells. MitoPure is a clinically validated solution backed by over 15 years of robust scientific research. Boost your cellular energy, enhance muscle strength and endurance, and even fight skin aging, all without changing your diet or exercise routine. I discovered MitoPure a couple of years ago after diving into the science of urolithin A. Since then, it's become a vital part of my wellness routine. For more information and to order, visit timeline.com/Hoffman. Use code Hoffman at checkout to receive 10% off MitoPure. Whether you're looking to support muscle health, enhance your skin routine, or invest in your long-term vitality, MitoPure is your scientifically backed ally in the quest for slowing down the aging process. That's timeline.com/Hoffman for MitoPure. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raul Hoffman. As we dig out from election 2024, it's been kind of a stressful week, also a week accompanied by a change in our clocks, which afforded us a little bit of extra sleep time, which we promptly lost as we watched election returns. And I think the theme of this week is, you know, the old Simon and Garfunkel song, Layla. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to see you again. You know, it's like, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon and it's twilight already again. So here we be. Yeah, we're off to the races.
I have more lights on. I have more lights on while we're doing this podcast than I did a week ago.
Exactly.
Because of the time change.
Yeah.
And it's just strange.
Yeah. So for listening audience, we record usually in the afternoons. It's a little bit of a different ballgame now as we go into the later afternoon hours. So I hope that you're all doing well, that you've withstood the stress and the elation of disappointment, depending on which side you were supporting in the election. Notwithstanding that, intelligent medicine will proceed regardless of which governmental regime
we shall forward carry on.
Yeah. So let's... answer your questions. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. And I'm really happy that we have such great questions. Kudos to you and our audience who are sending us great questions of general interest, questions that not only are interesting and germane, but also generous in that they often address prevalent concerns that it's not just unique circumstances that, a few individuals might worry about, but, questions of general interest for our listeners. So let's get ready to rumble.
Okay. Was there some kind of research, Dr. Hoffman, that you were talking about that you wanted to start with?
A study that really struck me this week was an interesting study. So, these days we often talk about the harms that sugar causes, right? This is hotly debated, but I think that few can doubt that our dramatically escalating sugar consumption over the last century or so, and especially, since the introduction of high fructose corn syrup, which is a readily available source of sugar that may be even worse than good old-fashioned table sugar, this has been a disaster for our health. So it'd be interesting to do a study on what would happen if we took a bunch of babies and we deprived them of any sort of sugar for a period of, say, a couple of years or even 1,000 days. But that study would be impossible to do because it would never pass muster with any kind of ethical review board. You know, you'd have to virtually put kids under and parents under armed guard to make sure that, no sugary breakfast cereal, no Halloween treats,
none of that would enter their diet, right? So it's just a study that's absolutely infeasible. Researchers figured out a way to take advantage of kind of a historical anomaly, which is the period in England, in the UK, during World War II, when they had severe sugar rationing. You remember that this is the time of the Blitz and the time of the blockade, the U-boat blockade of England, where they were sinking merchant ships. And it was a time of great austerity and rationing. Of course, all the priority was for the troops. You know, the British and Allied troops were getting whatever coffee, sugar, meat rations that weren't available to the civilian populace. So it unlike some parts of Europe where there was overt starvation, you know, literally starvation. England was in relative deprivation, particularly with sugar. So they did a study. They looked at what's called the UK Biobank, which is a vast repository of information about the health status of Brits. And they looked at individuals who had experienced sugar rationing. Now, of course, this is so long ago that a lot of these people were dead by now, but they had statistics that they could look at. Because it covers a long period of time. So the target audience were people who were children during that period. And for approximately 1,000 days, they had virtually no sugar. Okay? Then they were looked at. They were then looked at in terms of their risk for developing type 2 diabetes and hypertension, okay? And so proof of principle, just that one intervention, it did not speak to any kind of other intervention afterwards, because after the embargo or the rationing on sugar was lifted, after VE Day, the Brits could consume a lot of sugar, and they do. The Brits love their candy. I mean, they're people who actually prefer the English candy, what was it? Cadbury's, they treasure Cadbury's candy over U.S. brands. So it's not like the Brits don't consume candy. So after the 1,000 days, people resumed their normal dietary habits and they got tea sugar. So this is not lifelong sugar restriction. This is just the first 1,000 days after conception. And here's what they found. There was a 35% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
And a 20% less risk of hypertension as adults.
Mm-hmm.
So the authors are quoted as saying, by the way, they're authors from USC, University of Southern California, because, and why could they do that study? Because the data is available on the internet. You can actually search data. You don't have to be in England to do a study on Brits. So they say that studying the long-term effects of added sugar on health is challenging. It is hard to find situations where people are randomly exposed to different nutritional environments early in life and follow them for 50 to 60 years. The end of rationing provided us with a novel natural experiment to overcome these problems. And so,
wow. That is really something.
Big study. 60,000 participants born between... actually, this is interesting. October 1951 and March 1956. Wow. So you know what? I misspoke. According to the study, the rationing, England was so banged up that they had rationing that only ended in September of 1953. Wow.
Oh my goodness. That's a long time and after the war.
Yeah. And you talked to... Wow. You talk to older people in England, and they talk about how tough it was to grow up in the, like my age, people in the 70s, how tough it was to grow up even in the 1950s and 60s, because they were still pretty banged up from their experience in World War II. So anyway, and by the way, that wasn't even no sugar. That wasn't even no sugar. That was just very much reduced sugar.
Greatly rationed.
No sugar was recommended for children under 2. There was around 40 grams of sugar available for adults per day and 15 grams for children. If you think of you know, what a gram is, that's like 15 capsules of fish oil size for children. So, but then after rationing ended, sugar consumption doubled, and then we're off to the races again. Wow, pretty interesting.
That's, you know, really something.
So actually, I was wondering, because I said, you know, how do they know data for people during World War II? Because if these days, you'll think about it, the World War II crew is dying. You know, people who were born in the 1940s, they're less likely to be around and studyable. But people born in the 50s, okay.
Yeah. Really great stuff.
Yeah.
That's really something to look at.
Yeah.
The rationing. So it had to go down greatly. You'd have to think about what that would mean in a typical family. You can't put, you know, you can't ask for one lump, you know, one lump or two in your tea anymore.
Yeah.
Because then it became a novel thing.
Yeah. But I think what it speaks to is, I think a major source of sugar for children is juices,
candy.
You know, fruit drinks. Of course candy, but, you know, it's sort of the Trojan horse where it's not overtly, you know, candy we equate with sugar. Breakfast cereals. Breakfast cereals are just laced with sugar.
Yeah.
And then I think you're writing an article about salad dressing this week and how it's kind of a Trojan horse for not such great things either, especially sugar.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. One of the things I'll just mention now, I remember being, you know, out east at the house that we used to rent, and we'd have a lot of people over for dinner. And at the time, this was a couple of decades ago, at the time we were using, you know, the Good Seasons Italian dressing. It comes in a packet.
Yep.
They sell you a cruet with it. You put it in, you add your oil, vinegar, all that kind of thing, and you shake it up.
Yeah.
Well, everybody, we're all chomping down on salad. We are chomping it down.
Yeah.
We're eating more salad than we ever did. And one day, finally, I read the ingredients, and the first ingredient was sugar.
There you go.
The very first ingredient was sugar, which told the whole story.
Put a little sugar on it, honey. That's a song lyric, right?
Right. Oh, and what is that? The Dr. McDougall? Was that the McDougall diet? We're meant to eat sugar and starch. So put a little sugar on your food so that you'll want to eat.
Yep.
It was something he would advise.
And apropos of a starch diet, we actually have a question related to starch digestion. And
we do.
It's bioavailability. So should we tackle that question? I think that's a good
question. We can tackle that question.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see here. From Gene, we've got, I just listened to the Saturday show with What is Paleo? And it reminded me of an article that I had read, and it was all about, here's what it's called, Why Do We Love Carbohydrates?
Right. I saw that article.
The origins. Yeah. The origins predate agriculture and maybe even our split from Neanderthals. It was in Science Daily.
Okay.
So why do we love it? And a new study reveals how the duplication of the salivary amylase gene may not only have helped shape human adaptation to starchy food, but may have occurred as far back as more than 800,000 years ago, long before the advent of farming.
Okay, so
this kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I got to say though, that article's a little bit pop science. So let's take it apart a little bit. First of all, the digestion of starch begins to occur in the mouth, okay?
Salivary
glands make amylase, which breaks down long chains of glucose molecules, amylose, which is present in starchy foods such as grains and such as in potatoes, starchy vegetables, and starchy grains, and in beans to some extent. Okay. It is posited that this is not an attribute of all animals. For instance, it is doubtful whether carnivores like animals or dogs have a robust production of amylase, which begins actually the digestive process in your mouth. So one of the reasons to chew thoroughly is you begin the breakdown of at least starch in your mouth, not so much protein, but starch. It is thought, now humans are just great adapters to multiple environments. That's why we've inhabited every ecosystem from, you know, virtually the North Pole to the equator, you know, the tropics to the Arctic. And that is because we have great versatility in our ability to assimilate nutrients from a wide variety of foods, whether it be meat or whether it be plant sources of foods. And mm-hmm. so it is thought that one of the adaptations is our ability to digest milk, not just mother's milk, but milk from animals. And there's lactase, which is the yes. enzyme that breaks down lactose. They trace it to maybe only a few thousand years ago in Nordic parts of the world that we developed that. We just ended up through evolution developing the ability to digest the milk of adult animals, which is not natural.
Yeah.
It's not natural to any other animal in the animal kingdom. So that's the result of our versatility. So the thought is, according to research now, that they think this gene that helps us break down starch is very ancient, that it appeared mm-hmm. 800,000 years ago. Now, is it responsible for our cravings for sugar and starch? I don't know. I think that's kind of a leap. That's kind of a leap. So. That's kind of a logical leap.
Yeah.
Right? It means that we can break those things down, and maybe as a result, we get in the habit of eating those foods. And maybe as a result, we become insulin resistant, we get reactive hypoglycemia, and we're getting a roller coaster of carbohydrate craving. Yeah, maybe in modern times that was the case. One thing for sure, humans have not just a capacity to digest starch, but they have enormous capacity to seek out sweets, because sweets helped us with survival when we were subject to famines and we had the ability to store fat against times of hardship and deprivation.
Our Stone Age ancestors would eat the fruit that was available to fatten up for the upcoming famine.
But in season. It wasn't Hanko running fruit. I mean, it wasn't like in January you can go to the 7-Eleven and buy, you know, cherry pie, like a cherry, you know, Pop-Tart.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is infinitely sweeter than the kind of bitter berries, small bitter berries that were available then. But we had a more refined palate for, you know, discerning sweetness then. Now we require, you know, supercharging our sweet sensors with, you know, berries. We have to put extra sugar on berries to make them, even though they're sweeter than they once were. Anyway.
That's true.
So, I mean, that's kind of an intriguing article.
Kind of. The research also highlights how agriculture impacted this gene variation.
Yeah.
And they're just basically looking down the very narrow lens of looking at a particular gene.
Right. So I just comment, there's two ways that genes can be activated. One is if the gene is not present and suddenly through a mutation, we get the gene. And this would be a case where we have what's called an obligate gene, which is a mm-hmm. gene that either it's there and it allows, say, lactose consumption, or it allows starch consumption, or if it's absent, it doesn't. And then there's what are called facultative genes, which are kind of latent. In other words, they have the potential, but unless you are exposed to a food. And this appears to be the case with the lactase gene. If you have more lactose, it starts to activate. And if you don't, it kind of as with many adults, you suddenly become lactose intolerant. But it's not like it's absent completely. You may actually be able to induce it a little bit by gradually increasing your lactose, or in another case, you know, gradually increasing your starch. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Kind of use it or lose it thing, right?
Exactly. I mean, you can for example, if somebody has a dairy allergy, which is different from lactose intolerance, and they avoid dairy altogether, and then suddenly some months later they have a glass of milk, they may find that they get that usual crampy, bloaty, diarrhea consequence of not producing enough lactase.
Exactly.
Or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just not having dairy allergy, but just giving up dairy because they felt like it. It doesn't have to be because of a dairy allergy.
Exactly.
You likely wouldn't reintroduce any dairy at all.
Right.
Let's say because you just wanted to stop having any dairy.
Right. Because we don't want to confuse dairy allergy from lactose intolerance, because a dairy allergy is something different.
Two different things. Two different things.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Gene, thank you for that article. All right.
Good point at which to pause, because we want to allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. So listen up. Here it goes. You've heard me say for years that NT Factor is the breakthrough supplement that's proven to repair and renew your body's cells. That includes your immune cells, such as your T cells and white blood cells. NT Factor has been shown to contribute to a more robust and effective immune response. So now that we're in cold and flu season, NT Factor is combining with powerful antioxidants, vitamin C and D, to provide you with an immune booster bundle. Vitamin C and D help stimulate the production of white blood cells and activate immune cells, which play a key role in defending against pathogens. Together with NT Factor, they help modulate immune function, reduce inflammation, and promote overall immune health. For a limited time, buy a bottle of NT Factor with D3K2 and get a bottle of C1000 with NT Factor absolutely free. That's a savings of over $26. Just go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Save over $26 on the powerful cocktail of vitamins C and D with NT Factor at ntfactor.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They are what make intelligent medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to today's questions.
Okay. And speaking of dairy and lactose, let's see. Valerie writes, several years ago, I listened to some interviews on preventing Alzheimer's, and Dr. Dale Bredesen was pretty adamant when he said to eat goat milk and sheep's milk cheese, but never cheese from cows. I've been curious about the reason for this ever since, and I thought it might be due to the hormones that are fed cows, but I don't think that's what he had in mind. Can you shed any light on what makes sheep and goat cheese good to eat and not so much cows?
Yeah, you know, I think this is one of his more tenuous recommendations, because I don't know that there's strong evidence that dairy consumption is associated with an acceleration of cognitive decline. And, you know, if indeed it is, you know, one might say that, well, is it due to the high fat content? Well, there's not a lot of evidence that the fat per se is the cause of your cerebrovascular disease. So I don't think that's the case. Is it the additives to milk? I don't know, maybe.
I think cow's milk casein is more problematic to digest.
Yeah, but does it actually cause
that impact?
Does it cause
it doesn't cause
fibrillary tangles in the brain? You know, I don't know. I don't think it does.
I wonder if Dr. Bredesen was just speaking just candidly about, you know, a proper diet, as opposed not necessarily having to do with Alzheimer's, but the fact that goats and sheep smoked cheese is probably more better consumable, more digestible than any cow's milk, Gary.
I've got an article here that says it's entitled "The Effect of Casein Hydrolysate Intake on Cerebral Neural Regulation During Cognitive Tasks in the Elderly." Okay, it speaks to that, right? So our findings suggest there's a lot of verbiage. Something, 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 which could improve cognitive neural activities.
That's interesting.
Could improve.
All right.
But then, you know, like as with many controversies, there may be pro and con. Mostly protective effects of milk casein on brain function. You know, I worry sometimes that some of these are sponsored by dairy industry. But there's a fair amount on the protective effects of casein on brain function. You know, I just, when I saw that, and I did see that before we had to answer this question, I just said, I don't know. I think he's just kind of punting on that. I don't think there's a strong rationale. Now, I got to tell you that I limit dairy consumption for the reason that I tend to get congestion. I mean, I when I was in Iceland recently, a couple of years back, I loved their skyr, S-K-Y-R. And, you know, I had breakfast every day. It's delicious, like a really thick yogurt. And I was just loving that. And when they got back after my trip, I said, let me buy some of this skyr because it's yummy, yummy, yummy. And I just developed really severe nasal congestion. And I said, I got to stop. I'm going to stop.
Wait. So while you were in Iceland and you had this for breakfast, it didn't cause congestion then?
It may have caused some congestion, and I may have just been too happy.
Maybe it's a threshold effect.
During the vacation.
Or you were on vacation.
Or alternatively, it was, like you say, a threshold effect, like a cumulative effect. It wasn't like an immediate thing, like, you know, each and every time I had it, I had, you know, immediate, like, severe nasal congestion or breathing problems or like anaphylactic reactions, you know, that kind of thing. So,
while we're talking about casein, another problem with cow's milk casein is in autoimmunity.
Oh, yeah.
The same does go for any casein, any animal milk like sheep or goat. Mm-hmm. But cow's milk casein is particularly problematic in autoimmunity. Oh. And many people are able to eat goat's and sheep's milk.
We often recommend a gluten-free, casein-free diet for kids with neurodevelopmental problems. We recommend a paleo diet that is avoidance of gluten and dairy products for autoimmune patients.
Yes.
That, you know, because there is some element of autoimmunity, but is it associated with cognitive outcomes? Yeah. Maybe sometimes. And then, you know, there's another, and I think you... And we discussed this a little bit before we started the podcast, is there's some controversy about dairy and the pasteurization and homogenization process, which changes the particle size, which renders them more atherogenic. I've read some knocks on that. And that whole milk or raw milk has less of a propensity to have atherogenic effects. But, you know...
Wow.
But in most studies, you know, whole milk, high fat, you know, not low fat, is not associated with higher risk of atherosclerosis or cardiovascular disease or cerebrovascular disease. So, I don't know. I just am not.
Interesting.
I think that's the least of our worries.
True. Yeah. But we do know that there was a study that the people who drank more milk had more osteoporosis.
Yeah, okay.
And everybody's worried about, but I can't eat dairy and I have to get my calcium. How will I get my... Yeah, dairy's not the best place to get your calcium because a glass of milk also has all that sugar, all that lactose.
And also a lot of phosphoric acid, which is thought to be, you know, part of the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway.
Valerie, thank you for that very thoughtful question.
Okay. So just a reminder that if you're looking for supplements, D.R. Hoffman Stores, the place to find supplements. They're economical, discounted to Intelligent Medicine listeners, and you'll enjoy fast, free delivery because I've arranged for that for our listeners. Go to drhoffmanstore.com, and there you'll find thousands of supplements. I'm waiting for my shipment right now, but hey, it comes so fast. Before I end up recording this show, I may be able to go down to the lobby and pick up my package.
And there it will be.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I need to place an order soon.
Yeah, that's what happened a couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
I saw like an alert pop up on my screen. You have a package. And there it was.
And speaking of which, Louise writes, Dr. Hoffman, I ordered the Revive Collagen. Oh. I've been taking it for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I've definitely seen a difference with my nails.
Oh, really?
They're much stronger. They're not chipping like they used to. Too soon to give a report on skin as of yet, because it's only been 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But I hope to be as radiant as the Mona Lisa.
Oh, that's fabulous. I think that in order of outcome, I think you are more likely to see changes in your nails more rapidly. Hair a little takes a while longer because even, you know, if you get chemotherapy or something, it'll take like 18 months for you to get a full head of hair again. If you are looking at skin turnover is kind of slow. So if you're growing new healthy skin, your external skin is exfoliating, you know, literally we are like snakes. Yes. We shed a little bit. That's why we have dust mites that eat our leftover skin, you know, on our sheets and pillows. Yeah. And that's why we should clean our sheets and pillows, because these, you know, you can't even see it. It's like a dust-like particle, but it's what our epidermis, we shed it, you know.
And it's food for them.
Yep. But the point being that they take longer for skin. And then the longest, I would estimate, would be joints. I would think that if you're going to get any repair to articular surfaces in your knees or in your hips, that may take, months or even, you know, a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, look for improvements. So that product,
yeah, by the way, Louise.
It's called Revive, and it's by Brightcore. And we have a special offer on Brightcore for our listeners. It's a buy one, get one free offer. And if you listen to Intelligent Medicine, you go to drhoffman.com. You can find out about it. I don't have the copy in front of me right now.
Yeah. Louise, keep us apprised as you're taking it down the road. Let us know how it's all going for you. And thank you for letting us know. Terrific. All right. We've got a question from Tom. I am 74. I went to the doctor and I got my lipid panel. And my total cholesterol is 199 and my triglycerides are 143. My LDL is 115. He said he was going to put me on a medicine if it wasn't any better the next time I had a visit with him. And all of this came on suddenly, as my cholesterol numbers were fine 3 months ago. Could you tell me if there's anything I could do as far as my diet to lower my cholesterol before I get my labs taken again in 3 months? Because I really don't want to go on any more medicine. And do you have any idea why it would suddenly go up when it's been normal up until now?
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, don't hang on the results of one cholesterol test, because there's a lot of lab errors, frankly. It could be your diet. It could be that, you know, you're a little under the weather. It could be that your thyroid has slowed down, although that would produce more consistent changes. And here's please, folks, don't get hung up on your cholesterol. I mean, this is the most successful propaganda campaign ever undertaken in the history of mankind, is to make Americans cholesterol phobic. Now, I'm not saying that cholesterol doesn't have something to do with cardiovascular disease sometimes, but you know, as I pointed out in a recent show last week, in fact, if you listen to the show, I talked about a study that showed that fully 45% of people with very high LDL, LDL over 190, okay?
Oh my.
When your LDL is over 190, it's likely your cholesterol is pushing 300, you know, well into the high 200s. I'm not talking about your cholesterol. I'm talking about your LDL cholesterol, just the LDL.
Yeah.
So 45% of them had zero plaque, you know, if you want to make a decision about whether to go on a statin, never make it just based on your cholesterol alone. Always make it on the basis of whether or not, you have cardiovascular disease. Like, you know, yes, you've had, a stent or bypass or angina or heart attack. Okay. I get it. You know, you're at high risk. Or if you are asymptomatic, get a coronary artery calcium scan, or get a CT angiogram, even better, which will also show whether you have some soft plaque. In the event that you have zero hard plaque, you may have some soft plaque. Probably that is a relatively rare occurrence when you have a zero hard plaque score, but it can happen. So it could be argued like zero plaque doesn't completely exonerate you. But don't
that
just
clearly
get stampeded.
Tests is becoming more popular.
Don't get stampeded.
That clearly tests, And I'm not, the other thing.
Excuse me, I'm not going to even talk about lowering cholesterol before we decide if it's really necessary to lower cholesterol. The way I answer this question is,
one thing,
everybody asks, how do I lower my cholesterol? How do I lower? It's like, you don't need to lower your cholesterol if you don't have any plaque.
They still come back with, right.
Yep.
But here's one thing Tom can do about his triglycerides, Dr. Hoffman, are 143. We'd like to bring the triglycerides down to under 100. And Tom, the way you do get rid of the sugar, eat less starch, you know, all the things we were talking about at the thing. Lower your carbohydrates and your triglycerides when you get your labs done again in 3 months, they will fall off a cliff.
And for every 50-point reduction in your triglycerides, you get a 10-point reduction in your cholesterol, in your bad cholesterol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is terrific, which is wonderful. So start there before you get it all rejected.
Absolutely.
And so,
right.
Yeah.
Good point at which to go to part two. Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to tackle in part two.
Yeah. Reggie's got right high leg hamstring tendonitis or tendinopathy. And he's wondering, when can I return to playing sports?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting question, because this is a predicament that a lot of people have. So let's tackle that question when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla, because it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. You can get questions to us via questions@drhoffman.net. I'm very pleased to see that many of you are utilizing this avenue to get questions to us. And so we got more questions in the mailbag to tackle in part two, thanks to you. We'll be right back.